Good morning, everyone. I come to you from the lower 48, where the impediments to healthy salmon runs are many, and the political will to remove those impediments not so great. It's also worth noting that those impediments cropped up in the blink of an eye. I just mentioned that because we all know we just had an election. And I'm sure that we have a lot of Stand for Salmon supporters out here, and we just need to keep standing. So for the last dozen or so years, I've been writing about wild foods and the people who harvest them. And it was really only a matter of time before I would come around to salmon, because when you think about it, wild salmon are really the ultimate wild food in North America. They've organized entire societies around their life cycle. But first, let's take a little look back into my history. I grew up in New England, so I'm not from around here. That's the Connecticut River right there. That was really never far from any of the places I lived in New England, whether they be Connecticut, New Hampshire, or Vermont. And in my family, it was tradition on July 4th, like a lot of New England families, to have a salmon meal. And my grandmother would bake that Atlantic salmon and serve it with fried potatoes and peas and a little tureen of hollandaise sauce. And I can tell you that everyone at that table probably assumed, and this is a long time ago, but not that long, but they probably assumed that a crusty old New England fisherman from Gloucester or Portsmouth had hauled that fish up in his nets. But more likely, that fish began its life in an egg tray and then was fattened up, you know, in a feed pen in some Scandinavian fjord. Because the fact of the matter is that really there was no salmon culture left in New England by the time I came along. And the Connecticut River here, which used to be an important salmon river, really hasn't seen viable numbers of wild Atlantic salmon since even before the American Revolution. When I got out of college, the day after I got out of college, in fact, I pointed my car west and drove to California, where I got my first newspaper jobs. And after a couple of years in the Bay Area, I moved north to Seattle to go to the University of Washington. I was in their graduate writing program there. And halfway through that two-year program, I took a break, and I became a caretaker of a homestead in southwestern Oregon in the Rogue River Canyon. There's a picture of it right there. That is one of the few rivers in the lower 48 that isn't dogged by a road. It was a fantastic place to spend the better part of a year roaming thousands of acres of public land and fishing the Rogue, raising my own vegetables, etc., foraging the property. And there in the Rogue, in the heat of summer, often when it might be 100 degrees in the canyon, the summer Chinook were pushing upriver, and they would pause at the many creeks that flowed into the Rogue from the mountains, where that cooled, oxygenated water kind of helped them refuel and rest before their journeys upstream. And I could actually jump off the cliffs into the river amidst all these potted up Chinook and just kind of paddle around in the river among them. And I could even feel them kind of swimming around me and sort of through my legs. And they were all just sort of hanging out there, resting. They had no fear of me, really. Maybe they should have, because a couple of them did end up in the smoker. And it was at this wilderness retreat where I was the caretaker of this homestead that was owned by two brothers that I really began to feel like the Northwest was my home, and that I was connected to all these creatures around me, including the salmon. One of the brothers is an artist, who lives on the Oregon coast. That's one of his prints. He makes pottery and prints. His name is Frank Boyden. That, by the way, is called The Clock of Fall. And he's known all over the world for his ceramics. And then the other brother became my steelhead mentor. That's Bradley Boyden. And that's where I became on the Rogue. That's actually a picture of the Skeena there. But on the Rogue is where I became attached to my first steelhead. Really, I've been tethered to these remarkable fish ever since. So that leads me back to upstream. After writing about wild foods for a dozen or so years, it was really time to tackle these iconic fish. And I knew that I was wading into some tricky waters. But I just was fascinated by the people who were connected to these fish. Even though these many different user groups were often, as Ted mentioned, not on the same page. So I decided that I would begin my book in the marketplace, because the marketplace is really sort of our most basic connection to these fish, just as consumers. And if you go to a place like Pike Place Market in my hometown, Seattle, you will see crowds of people gathered around the displays of salmon that are stacked up on those big sort of pillows of ice, almost like stacked treasure. And you will see their eyes popping out of their heads. It's almost like there's something in our DNA that connects us to these fish. And then, of course, it's become, you know, it's a pretty big deal in Seattle. And when the first Atlantic salmon, or when the first Alaskan salmon start showing up in the spring, we even have a big media hoopla where, for instance, when the Copper River salmon show up, they get the special treatment of being walked down the gangplank by the captain and first mate of Alaska Airlines. And the media shows up, and there's a celebrity chef cook-off on the tarmac, and you wouldn't believe the prices that these fish fetch in the marketplace. Often upwards of $60, $70 a pound. It's pretty remarkable. There they are, wild fish caught by wild fishermen, as the sign says. And so that's where I started my narrative, because I think that is really our most basic connection to these fish as consumers. And then I proceed to a restaurant where you can get one of those pieces of Copper River Chinook for a cool $56, I think it was, the night that I ate there. People, and by the way, they sell out right away. People are willing to pay, you know, top dollar for this wild salmon coming from Alaska in a place that is also known for its salmon iconography. And yet, in Puget Sound, the commercial fishery is, you know, a fraction of what it used to be. Pretty much all of our fishing boats now travel up here to go fishing. From there, I continued on you know, certainly there's a lot to be said about Alaskan salmon, but if we want to talk about, really, through history, the most famous salmon of all, it would be on the Columbia River, where people came from miles around, from as far as the Great Plains even, to barter for salmon, and the reputation of the spring Chinook spread far and wide. And so I spent a little time on the Columbia fishing, hanging out with tribal leaders and tribal fishermen as well. Here's a scene of traditional dip netting going on the Klickitat River, a Columbia River tributary. And by the way, I've peppered some of these slides with quotes from different personalities in the book. Just some food for thought there. Maybe a couple of them I'll read at some point. But of course, what was once the greatest salmon highway of all on the entire planet has now been reduced from its former grandeur. And as you begin your sort of drive upstream, as I did, following it from the mouth at Astoria all the way to Redfish Lake in Idaho, where sockeye salmon and Chinook salmon perform the longest migration in the lower 48, you run into, of course, quite a few dams that are part of the new regime, the hydropower regime. And here's Bonneville. You can see the fish ladder in the lower right-hand corner. And there is one that I was lucky enough to catch on film, making it upriver. And when you go into the bowels of the dam, you'll be surrounded by all sorts of tourists getting off the bus and rushing through the doors where the interpretive center is. And none of them are heading to see the turbines or all the other implements of the power producing capability of the dam. They're all heading downstairs where the fish ladder viewing chamber is. And they're pushing their faces right up against the glass to be just a little closer to these incredible fish. And you can see right there that we have a wild specimen with the intact adipose. But in reality, about three-quarters of the salmon that will pass through that viewing chamber will be hatchery fish now. And so I continued upriver, and there is Redfish Lake, where the sockeye still manage to get through eight dams on their way to spawn in the lake and the little creeks emptying in the lake. And I tell the story of Lonesome Larry. And I bet a lot of people in this room know the story of Lonesome Larry. In 1992, he was the only sockeye salmon, wild sockeye, to return to Redfish Lake. Where formerly there might have been tens of thousands. In fact, there was even a commercial fishery for these fish in the late 1800s to supply the miners in nearby mining towns. So there was one sockeye who made it back in 1992, and of course he was dubbed Lonesome Larry. And for his diligence, he was knocked over the head and relieved of all his milt, and this is his final spawning ground. Okay, this cryogenic tank. And I actually went to the broodstock hatchery, and we have all kinds of different hatcheries in the Northwest, by the way. You've heard of our mitigation hatcheries. Well, we also have what we call broodstock hatcheries. And supposedly, those are hatcheries that are keeping our wild runs on life support, although there are those who would beg to differ because any sort of hatchery, no matter how well crafted with science and the objective of keeping the run wild, it's still a hatchery. But this particular sockeye salmon, Lonesome Larry, sired 10 generations of future sockeye. And I will say that, this is the situation that we have run into now where I come from, because this is the southernmost run of sockeye in North America. It also travels in the lower 48, the longest distance, and these are some of the highest elevation spawning salmon in the world. At Redfish Lake, they're at about 7,000 feet. And so for all these reasons, they have a suite of genetics that is really important to the sockeye genome, and so we're keeping them on life support. A lot of people would argue with that, though, saying that, this is way too many tax dollars that are going to trying to support a run that is barely surviving. And so it's just yet another example of the sort of contentious politics that we have in making these sort of decisions, godlike decisions, about who lives and who doesn't. I should mention that throughout the book, I'm participating in all of these events. This is not as told to journalism. This is really firsthand reportage. And so I got down there in the roundup and helped them. This is the Salmon River near Redfish Lake. And, I mean, you can look at it there. What a beautiful river. It looks almost like a Montana trout stream. You know, 200 years ago, that would have been teeming with wild salmon. But here we are trying to round up just maybe a handful of sockeye that managed to get past the weir and are in the river. And the reason they're doing this is they need every last one for the broodstock hatchery, and also so that they can make sure that none of these fish are diseased. And they will then DNA sample them so that they know the parentage of all these fish going back several generations. And that way they can decide when it's time who gets to go back to the lake to spawn in the wild and who will be kept at the hatchery to be spawned by us, in effect. And here are the biologists swimming with the lucky fish who get to return to the wild to spawn, like these. So my journey also took me down the Oregon coast to hang out with sport fishermen and the guides who make their living. And in the case of the Oregon coast, those guides are competing for a resource with other resource extractors, where timber harvest, obviously, is still a big deal, especially in Oregon. And you have people like Guido Rahr from the Wild Salmon Center. I'm sure maybe some of you have met Guido before. And there he is holding up a fly-caught Chinook, the likes of which we don't have very many of any longer, a wild Chinook, late-season Chinook. This picture, I think, was taken in January. And then, of course, I spend some time in my own backyard because, you know, the urbanization of salmon habitat is just as big a deal, if not bigger, than the hydropower and the hatcheries and the harvest and all the other issues that these fish face. And here I am netting a pink salmon, wild pink salmon that I caught on the Duwamish River. That's Seattle's working waterway, our river. We also call it a working waterway because we have kind of funny terms like that. Instead of river, it's the working waterway. And in the background there, you can see the Boeing plant. And in fact, this bridge, this nice bridge right here, no longer exists because that was torn down because it was earthquake prone. The pink salmon are sort of, they're like a little silver lining that we have. In fact, in recent years, pink salmon have been coming back in higher numbers than previously, which has everybody kind of scratching their heads and wondering if maybe they're the canary in the coal mine, while all the other runs continue to decline. It's the pink salmon that every other year brings the anglers out in droves and also sells a lot of fishing licenses for the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. So those are some of the places, not all of them, some of the places that I've gone, some of the user groups that I've come into contact with, some of the issues that need to be talked about. And what I'd like to do now is sort of delve a little deeper into it, because really my interest is in the characters, the people that work with salmon every day. And in doing the reportage for this book, you know, I met with hundreds of different people, interviewed them, recorded interviews, took pictures, thousands of photos. These are mostly my photos, by the way. Over time, there were certain characters that just sort of emerged. People that I wanted to go back and spend more time with. And they show up again and again in the book. And this is one of them. This is Rene Henry. He's a fisheries ecologist. I'm just going to read this quote because I think he's sort of emblematic of a new breed that we're seeing more of lately. Salmon conservation is like learning to snowboard. At first, it's all about avoiding obstacles, not running into a tree. After a while, it's about picking a line and moving gracefully around the obstacles. And now it's about using those same obstacles for leverage, jumping off a rock and expressing the beauty of the vision. Obviously, Renee is a snowboarder in his spare time. I love that analogy. We're actually going to take a look at the rock in this case and how he is getting a little leverage off of that rock, as it were. In California, where he works as the California director for Trout Unlimited, the rock, you know, the sort of the elephant in the corner is big ag, okay? And so agriculture is really, and obviously other attendant issues, but big ag is the rock. Here's the Yuba River, one of the last holdouts for wild fall Chinook in the Central Valley of California. The Central Valley, by some estimates, produces more than a third of what Americans eat. It also had salmon runs that are just hard to imagine today, particularly spring Chinook. But these days, our waterways, as we might call them, look more like this. You know, the Central Valley of California might be the most managed landscape on the planet. It's crisscrossed by canals, and as the saying goes, in California, the state was able to achieve what God could not. Water runs uphill. The Central Valley is one of the flattest landscapes I've ever seen. Mostly denuded of trees. You can see a little fringe in the background there following a canal. An incredibly managed landscape. And this is the reality in California. This is the rock. It's not going to change. So fisheries ecologists and biologists, people like Renee Henry and his colleague there, Jacob Katz, from California Trout, they have to work within this system. So guys like this, they're sort of part of this new breed, you know, that are working, you know, for Fish and Wildlife, for the BLM, for the Forest Service, for NGOs, and they're bringing sort of new thinking. It's not just resource extraction as usual thinking from the past. They're really trying to think outside of the box. And so I'm going to show you one example of how they're trying to get leverage on the rock to make a nice little jump. So this right here is the Lower Sacramento in the Yolo Bypass. And this is where most of the Sacramento's water is diverted during flood stage in the winter through the Yolo Bypass. It's where a lot of the nation's rice harvest is happening. This is a test plot here at Nags Ranch where they're growing rice, and you can see the paddies. Okay, these are all paddies right here. They're also growing salmon. And what they're doing here at Nags Ranch is they are breaching the dikes. That's a word that farmers do not want to hear. That's the same word that you might hear in relation to the Lower Snake River dams. It's definitely not a word that farmers like to hear. But they're experimenting with breaching the dikes and letting salmon through the gates to forage in these rice paddies. Because the fact of the matter is there's no floodplain habitat left in the Lower Sacramento. 90% of the Central Valley's habitat has been lost, okay? So what people like Renee and Jacob Katz have to do is work within this framework, okay, to try and figure out how to refire nature's sort of natural capacity, its natural production, in a highly managed landscape. So this particular project that they're working on, they call the Nigiri Project, Nigiri being a type of sushi rice. So fish and rice. Here I am with Jacob pulling a little seine through one of the paddies to see what's in there. And you can see with the little quote I've put in there, reconciliation. I don't know how many of you have heard that word used. It was new to me. But down in California, they're not really talking about restoration anymore, okay? You know, the environment is not a 65 Mustang that's rusted out and sitting under a tarp and waiting for a new owner with deep pockets who can restore it to show quality, okay? The environment is highly managed, and if anything, we are just trying to reconcile our own use of that landscape with perhaps some more natural productivity, if we can. So in the case of the Nigiri project, letting these fish out to forage in the rice paddies allows them to actually grow bigger and stronger before they make their push out to the ocean. So here we are. We've pulled in the seine, and this is what we're finding, young Chinook salmon, which have a much harder time in the Sacramento River proper because the river has been channelized, it's been diked, it's deep, it's swift, it's cold. It's not good salmon habitat. But out in these rice paddies that sort of mimic the floodplains that they would have seen, say, 200 years ago, the fish are actually growing stronger, fatter, and are able to make the journey out into the hungry ocean in higher numbers and come back in higher numbers. So far, that's what the data is showing. This project's been going on for several years now, and this is just one of the ways that we are trying to sort of reconcile our use of the landscape and still have salmon in a place like California. And there's the rice coming from these particular growers, the Nigiri project. Renee is also working on this down in the San Joaquin River. If you think of the San Joaquin and the Sacramento, they kind of come together right before emptying into the San Francisco Bay. They're the two faucets that irrigate the Central Valley, which is about 450 miles long from Red Bluff to Bakersfield. And as I mentioned, by some estimates, produces maybe a third of what Americans eat. So down on the San Joaquin to the south, they have quite a few duck refuges, and there's a big hunting tradition down there. Even though waterfowl, which used to number 20 to 40 million in the Central Valley, are now more at like a million. But they still have these duck refuges, and they're breaching the gates, breaching the dikes and installing gates so that the salmon can forage out in the duck refuges in the winter. And this is another version of the Nigiri project that's being experimented right now. So, sort of jumping off the rock, which is big ag, to try and refire those natural engines of productivity. So that's kind of what's happening with a few of my characters working in the sort of science realm, okay? Now I want to talk about another character who's a commercial fisherman. And this is happening kind of closer to my home in Seattle. This is the ferry to Lummi Island. And you would board this ferry up near Bellingham, Washington, and you would take it. It takes about 10 minutes over to Lummi Island, which is part of the San Juan Island archipelago. And out there on Lummi Island, there is a long tradition of a type of fishing called reef netting. Maybe you've heard of it. It was a specialty of tribes in the Salish Sea, especially those in northern Puget Sound, and they would intercept salmon that were heading for the Fraser River, obviously one of our great salmon streams of the West Coast. And reef netting almost went extinct, but there are a few people that are still practicing it, and this is one of them. His name is Riley Starks, and I met Riley for the first time up on Lummi Island. He's been involved sort of on both ends of the sort of the salmon production pipeline. He's been a restaurateur, and he's also been a commercial fisherman for most of his life. And he came to reef netting kind of later, after having been a gill netter and a purse seiner, herring fisherman, a crabber, and he came to reef netting when he moved to Lummi Island and found this tradition, which was barely hanging on. In this picture, he's holding an ancient reef net anchor that he found one day while walking along a beach on Lummi Island, and it probably washed up during a big storm, and he felt like this was sort of, this was telling him something, that this was something he had to do. So he got into reef netting, and he's still doing it. This was, I think, back in the early 90s when he started, and they've been perfecting it since then. But the general outline is this. It's a fixed form of fishing, and you deploy what is called the reef. And the reef is a bit of leisure domain. It's an illusion. Traditionally, Native Americans would have strung the reef together with beach grass and nettle cordage and that sort of thing. And it would be, say, 200 feet long. And it would be anchored with one of those stones that he was holding up there in that previous photo. It would be anchored on the bottom, and the reef would just hang in the water. And it was like a big funnel. And at the end of the funnel, it would sort of narrow like a funnel, and it would bring the fish up in the water column. And then at the end of the funnel was a net waiting. The net was strung between two war canoes, and when the salmon were within range, they were hauled up with the net, and that's how it worked. And you needed the right conditions for reef netting. The fish all had to be heading in the same direction. In this case, they're going north with the current towards the Fraser River. And so the waters off of Lummi Island were a perfect place to do this, just south of the international border with Canada. And the salmon have come in through the Strait of Juan de Fuca, taken a left turn, and they're heading north. And there they are in the trap. Okay. Now, today, it's done a little differently. They have fiberglass boats, they have nylon nets and all that. But the concept is still essentially the same, that the reef is deployed. It's like a big funnel. And then you have, up in these towers, you have the spotters. And the spotters wait for the fish to arrive. And when they see them, they kind of make the call. They say, they're coming in, they're going out, they're coming in. Everybody else on deck is waiting for the final call. And then when the salmon are finally in range of the net, they give the call and they trip a wire. And immediately these gears kick in and the net is hauled up. And actually, as you can see here, there's no fossil fuel involved in this. Solar panels right here. Charging a deep cycle battery on board the barge, and that turns the gears, which have been scavenged, interestingly, from old airplanes, from B-52s, the Bombay door openers, and parts like that. So it's really a sort of a one-off kind of deal. They scavenge the parts, they've put it together, and this is how they reef net. And standing up in that spotting tower, I can tell you, is a pretty amazing and contemplative sort of way to pass the time. And it really combines sort of the most exciting elements of sport fishing with also just the commercial fishing. Everything about it is just so much fun. And I could easily see spending a summer doing this. And in fact, I did get to go down and, as they say, grab web in the reef netter's parlance and haul in some fish. And you can see here kind of what it looks like when they're coming in. So the fish, the net comes up below the fish, and the reef netters grab web, and they make sort of a siphon. And the fish just slide down and into these waiting live tanks. And over the course of, say, 10 minutes, 15 minutes or so, they swim off the lactic acid buildup of their capture in the tank. And then at that point, they're gilled and they're moved over into a bleed tank. And all of this is timed with a simple egg timer on deck. Very high tech. And then they're moved to ice, totes, and they're sent off to the processor. But you can see produces a very beautiful, most of these are sockeye, although they do fish for some pinks. And in fact, pinks might be the future for this fishery, but there's a beautiful sockeye. But there are a couple of reasons why Riley Starks really wanted to get into this style of fishing. And this slide here kind of illustrates one of them. It's really the only form of selective gear out there. This is a king salmon right here. You can't see it, but it has an intact adipose. So this is an ESA-protected king in Puget Sound. And there it was. It was much bigger than the sockeye. There were about four or five kings like this on this particular pole, swimming around with maybe 30 or 40 sockeye. And the beauty of this is that the reef netters are able to sort the fish live in the tank, and they gilled the sockeye, and then they took the kings and they just lifted them gently overboard, and those kings were off on their way to perhaps keep the genetic stock alive in some little distant tributary of the Nooksack River or the Fraser, some river in northern Puget Sound. and so you can't really do this with a gill net or a purse seine or a troller. But with the reef netting, you can. So that's one of the reasons. Riley Starks calls it the most sustainable form of fishing on the planet. The other thing is, you know, a more, just pragmatic concern. Produces a really good piece of fish. You're not going to have any net marks on these fish. They're not going to be bruised. They're not going to get stepped on deck or, you know, smothered in a big heap on board. It produces really good fish. One day when I was visiting the reef netters, there was a chef and caterer from Atlanta who had shown up. She had been selling reef net sockeye to her clients for a number of years and finally decided that she wanted to come all the way out to Lummi Island to see where these beautiful fish were caught so she could see it for herself. And she was just gushing with excitement in her southern drawl. And that's, you know, the sort of person that Riley Starks is really trying to bring these fish to. Because they do cost more. You know, this is not a cheap cut of fish. But when you think about it, in a piece of fish like that, all these sort of environmental taxes, if you will, are paid for up front. It's not going to be on the back end, you know, through bonds to repair damaged environment or that sort of thing that future generations pay. It's all paid on the front end. It's a more expensive piece of fish, and it should be. I want to show you a few. I know we've been getting into some pessimistic stuff, but, you know, where I live, we're up against a lot. And I guess I just bring this up because, you know, everyone has thought that they were immune. In Western Europe, they thought their fish runs were going to go on forever. In New England, they thought their fish runs were going to go on forever. In the Pacific Northwest, where I live, we certainly thought that, okay? History tells us that doesn't happen. So all the things that are happening down where I live are going to happen to some degree or less here, okay? Especially the urbanization piece. But there are also reasons for hope. So I think you're all familiar with the Elwha Dam removal on the Olympic Peninsula. This is an area I'm pretty familiar with. I've done a lot of backpacking up in this region of the Olympics. I've done a lot of fishing. Boy, to go see it without that big plug right there, well, two plugs, actually, is pretty incredible. So this was where the former reservoir was, and you can see now the free river cutting its path to the sea, and all of that. This picture was taken a few years ago. Since then, all of that sort of sandbar in the middle that you see there, the patches of gray, has filled in with alder and other native plants, and it really is looking like a restored river. And I can tell you that the fish are recolonizing the Elwha faster than the scientists thought. They are already ahead of schedule. And in fact, literally as soon as the last piece of concrete came out, there were already steelhead that were moving up into the system past the barriers. So that's one, you know, good piece of news. Maybe we'll see this happen on the Klamath system soon. Perhaps we'll see it, hopefully, on the Lower Snake. So, you know, people are mobilizing. The other thing I'll say about the Elwha is between the time that Congress authorized the removal of the Elwha dams and when the first piece of concrete came out, there was a 20-year span of time. It took 20 years, basically, for the community of Port Angeles, Washington, to sort of come around and see that this was a good thing for them. During that time, there were a few sort of key figures in that local scene who changed their opinions about dam removal. And when those people changed their opinions, they brought others over to the other side with them. So when key people within the community started thinking differently, all of a sudden the tide turned. So that's worth keeping in mind. And then I just want to leave you now with the epigraph of my book, because I think it really speaks to the overall subject matter, from the great poet and essayist Gary Snyder and his book, The Practice of the Wild. Great brown bear is walking with us. Salmon swimming upstream with us as we stroll a city street. So thanks very much. Did we?
Yeah, we're in good shape. We have time for questions. So thank you, Langdon. So we have quite a bit of time for questions, and we do have a mic here. So if you would like to ask Langdon a question, now would be a good time to get that word in advance. Who's got a question? Aha. I was just going to take time.
Thank you for that great presentation. I just wondered if you had looked into at all the coho salmon die-off going on in Washington State, trying to link it most likely to the stormwater runoff.
Yeah, that's right. So there is now evidence pointing to the stormwater issue there. You know, also sort of in parallel to that, you might have followed the culvert issue in Washington State that went all the way to the Supreme Court. And in that case, the tribes won, so the state is on the hook to replace those culverts. So that's a big deal. And that will really impact coho especially. You know, I fish for coho. I'm a beach fisherman. You know, that was sort of a bread and butter fish. For those of us who fish the beaches around Puget Sound. And we have seen a really big decline. As I was speaking with someone earlier, I've lived in Seattle now for about 27 years. And I can say so little more than, say, a generation. And I can say in the time that I've lived there, I've seen the decline of these fish. So this isn't – it's more – than just cyclical. I mean, when you start to connect the dots, we're really seeing a downward trend. And we're seeing it not over a really long period of time. We're seeing it over a short interval. You know, where I live, it's just so complicated. There are tons of orgs that are working to try and reverse this, but they just don't have a lot of teeth. You know, with the coho, so we have the urban growth boundary in Seattle. You know, they need those little streams often that are even right within the city limits or just outside the city limits. But they're so degraded. And we're seeing this up and down the West Coast, you know, the coho used to be thought of as sort of the redwood fish, right? Because they had a relationship with those redwood forests in California, in Northern California, right along the coast. And when those big trees would fall over, they would create pools, and those streams were very winding, with lots of woody debris in them. They were just perfect coho habitat. And then, you know, we all showed up and started cleaning those streams because we thought, oh, well, we want them to be navigable, or we just want them to look more like a pretty stream the way we envisioned it, sort of with our Victorian roots or something. So we sort of busily, you know, set about sort of manicuring all these streams. Well, next thing you know, there's no coho left in them. So to your question, yes, the storm runoff is a huge issue for coho. The real question is, are people going to come together and do something about it? And that's really a central part of my book, because it's really about people. And it's about people working together. With Renee Henry, the scientist from California, who I write quite a bit about in the book, one of his real mantras is trying to diversify the conservation community. Because, you know, a salmon stream is really diverse, right? And he likes to say that how are we going to start restoring a system that's diverse if the people who are doing the restoring aren't diverse themselves? And so he's really working hard. One of his favorite projects is actually a fishing derby on the San Joaquin River. The San Joaquin is just starting to come back to life. And I'm going to talk about this a little more tonight at our wild food dinner. I might read a passage from this chapter. But with this, the San Joaquin is very interesting because it was all the water rights along the San Joaquin were divvied up. We're talking, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s. Those water rights were divvied up at a time in the sort of natural cycle that was very wet, okay? So today, there is more water in the San Joaquin that has been allocated to agriculture than actually flows through the river in an average year. What this means is that the San Joaquin, which used to be a spring Chinook producer par excellence, now runs dry for something like 40 miles. Yeah. And so a bunch of orgs got together and sued the state. This is years ago. And to everybody's surprise, they won. So now it's mandated that 15% of the San Joaquin must flow to the sea. So one of Renee Henry's jobs is to drive around the Central Valley and go to these meetings with these little farming communities and explain to them, this is what's happening. This is law. We need to figure out a way to get 15% of this river to flow to the sea. And by the way, we're reintroducing salmon to it. And they have all these projects going on right now to that effect. And how are we going to pull this off? And so, you know, he's not just a scientist. In many ways, the more important aspect of his job is being a communicator, working with other people, getting people to work together. That's really what it comes down to. Because the fact of the matter is that when you have a river that runs dry, that used to be one of the great, you know, spring Chinook rivers on the West Coast, that's crazy. I mean, we're talking about, there are all sorts of studies now that show, that correlate human health in urban areas with bird diversity and with, you know, tree canopy percentage. There are communities up and down the West Coast, well, really all over the country, that are trying to plant more trees, that are trying to do things because they know that human health in these communities can be sort of quantified by what the sort of biodiversity is like surrounding them. And so for me as a writer, just tagging along with Renee as he goes and talks to these water users, many of whom would have him bound and tied on the next train out of town, you know, is pretty interesting. And he's a very politic guy and has really learned how to talk to people. And that's such an important skill. And, you know, we're in our silos right now, and more than ever, as the most recent election has shown us, we're polarized. And we just hear the news that we want to hear, and we can be kind of almost in these impermeable membranes, you know, and not see what's going on the other side. And his job is really to break through those barriers, to reach people and explain to them, you know, we have a shared responsibility for this river, the San Joaquin, but bringing this river back to life is also going to bring our communities back to life. And so he talks about this fishing derby that Trout Unlimited hosts on the San Joaquin every year. And he says, and he's African-American, and, you know, he routinely talks about just how white the conservation community is and how we need to get more diversity into it. But he talks about this fishing derby as the most diverse event that he's ever attended in his life. You're talking about people from all sorts of different ethnic backgrounds and creeds and colors from these little farming communities in the Central Valley coming together, you know, just to take part in one of the oldest forms of recreation in human history. As he says, the typical Californian, he says, everybody's fishing and everybody's stoked. And, you know, that really says it all. And I'm a huge admirer of his because he is treading on difficult ground here. It is not easy to be a scientist and bring this sort of news to the people, especially people who don't want to hear it. And on top of that, to do it skillfully. So this is a really long-winded way of getting back to your coho question. And, you know, I don't have a really specific answer for you on that. It's something that they're working on, you know, where I live. But it's just one of many issues that needs attention. There are just so many. And I can tell you that those issues are migrating north. You need to be ready for them because they will be here. They're already here. Next question.
In the recent election that you referred to, our Stand for Salmon ballot initiative was opposed with a variety of arguments. And one of the big arguments was that all the problems are out in the ocean, and therefore we don't have to do anything about it. We don't have to look at our regulations. We don't have to worry about our freshwater habitat. It's all out there. So I was wondering, in terms of the Pacific Northwest, how that argument goes, how you
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, I personally think that's patently false. You know, it's easy. It's sort of a way to dodge the bullet. Oh, right. The problems are all out in the ocean, and the ocean is governed by these cycles that we are too big for us to understand. And this is nature. Yeah. Well, I mean, sure. There are big cycles happening out there, and we can see those cycles are starting to change in ways that are somewhat unpredictable with climate change. But we need to be doing our share on land. And, you know, when you look at, for instance, place like Idaho, central Idaho, high elevation, great habitat, this could be refugia for the future. For salmon. The streams are cold. They're certainly going to be colder than other parts of the country as climate change continues. And yet, you know, we have the four Snake River dams, which are really preventing all that habitat from being used. And that's just another great example of sort of politics trumping common sense. Because really, that's just the Snake River dams are part of the culture wars. And, you know, it's, I understand I've spent a lot of time out in that region and the people are afraid that, you know, other people from the city are basically taking away their infrastructure. never mind that that infrastructure isn't providing the benefits that, you know, everybody thought they would. I mean, we're getting very little electricity out of them. We can irrigate in other ways. You know, most of the grain can be barged, or can be done by truck or rail. And so there's really, I mean, if you look at the ledger from a strictly economic standpoint, there's no reason to have those lower Snake dams. But they represent an idea and a fear more than any sort of, you know, common sense, pragmatic thing. And so there's a struggle there, you know, and until we get some pillars of that community, just like with the Elwha dams, to maybe come to the other side, there's going to be a struggle. And so really, that's all about politics, ultimately.
Time for one more question.
Your example with rice and agriculture was really interesting. We see very often that partnership occurs with direct industries, right? Commercial fishermen are out in force for the protection of salmon, and that's great. Are there other indirect industries still related, like agriculture, like that rice production, that are proactively participating, examples you can think of that have found, to the benefit of salmon and salmon habitat that we might engage here in Alaska? Are there examples like that that we should be looking towards that we're not being
Right. So if I'm understanding, are there other sort of examples like the Nigiri project that could be employed in Alaska where you're taking infrastructure, managed landscape that already exists and tweaking it in a certain way to promote better salmon production?
Right. Indirect related industries.
That's a good question. I don't know about up here. You know, I can't see how the sort of, mining and forestry businesses could be sort of tweaked in such a way to produce better salmon habitat. Although, when it comes to timber harvest, I mean, there is, you know, where I live, there are ways to, I mean, you know, the heyday of logging has come and gone. And logging communities are obviously, especially in places like the Olympic Peninsula and the Oregon coast, they're on the decline. And so how do you take those communities and give them economic opportunities? One thing has been forest thinning and actually creating better salmon habitat by taking some of those trees and putting them back in the creeks and rivers the way they would have been. Essentially doing habitat restoration through forest thinning. I'm not sure really how workable that is up here. Nothing comes to mind at the moment for Alaska, but I'll think about that. With people like Renee Henry and Jacob Katz who come up with these ideas like the Nigiri Project, and then with the San Joaquin and with the ducks, with the duck refuges, they call that FX, which stands for fins, feathers, forever. Fins and feathers forever. They're really thinking outside the box to come up with these plans. And, of course, they meet a lot of resistance at first. With Nag's Ranch, where they're doing the Nigiri Project, that's in association with UC Davis, where there's a very famous fisheries program. A lot of these fisheries ecologists and biologists came through that program. And so they have this sort of friendly place where they can do these experiments. But the next piece there is going to be convincing, the private farmers to do this sort of thing. And they're going to need grants for that. They're going to need public buy-in for that. But what they're doing now is they're just simply showing the data. And the data is that when they allow these fish out into the rice paddies to forage, the fish have so much more to eat than in the channelized river that they're going out to sea much stronger and fitter and coming back in higher numbers. And that's what the data is showing. So they're going to have to take that data at some point and get more public buy-in. And that's like the next hurdle. And again, that's sort of the politics piece. And so it's very convoluted and complicated. There's so many moving parts to making this happen. Really, what it says is that it's better to not build that dam than to have to take it out in the future. So if you can try and do something, it's just like with your own personal health. You want to take good care of your health, yourself, rather than be worrying later, how you can, what you can do medically. I'm sorry I can't answer your question better there. Nothing is really coming to mind right away, but I'm sure if you did some research on it, you might find some people doing some interesting things up here that relate to that.
Okay, well, I know there's a few more questions, but we are going to have a networking break here in a moment, and Mike is going to be around, so if I didn't get to you because I was clearly showing proximity bias to the side of the room, you will have a chance to talk to Mr. Cook. So a couple of announcements, but before I do that, please join me in thanking our keynote speaker.
Thanks very much.